The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
In terms of the meeting of different cultures, a culture that I've had very little contact with over my many years that I've lived in the United States is Native Americans, indigenous people of this country. And it turned out that one of my sons, maybe my son's, who's now 21, his best friend, is Native American. We didn't really know that. Maybe he didn't even know it. It was kind of a little bit, I don't know, it wasn't really part of his family, his immediate family. And but when he was 18, he kind of understood. He was told he had, you know, he's kind of a mixed background, all kinds of countries and cultures, but including them was Native American. And so he looked into it, I guess, when he was 18. And his granduncle was actually, the tribal leader of his particular tribe, so he has a strong family connection. So he invited us, me, to go to down to San Juan Bautista yesterday, because his particular tribe, he's kind of part of what some people call the Ohlone, who are the Native Americans of the peninsula here, going down towards Big Sur area and Salinas area. And his particular band, tribal band, centered around Morgan Hill. And so San Juan Bautista is a very, very significant place for them because there's a San Juan Bautista mission. And so his ancestors were, Native American ancestors, were basically kind of gathered up by the missionaries and forced to come and live in these missions that were built up and down El Camino here. And many of them died. I think they started being gathered together and to work and be kind of slaves or be converted in about 1779 in San Juan Bautista area. And by 1830, 19,000 of them had died at the mission because of all kinds of conditions. Once California became part of the United States, someone went up to Sacramento to make a claim to this ranchos down there, and there was this land of theirs which was considered sacred, apparently it was being kind of, for some reason it was kind of reserved for the Native Americans, but when this people went to Sacramento, the new government, to say this is ours, and the government said, well, it says here that this belongs to the Native Americans, and their reply to that was, oh, they're all dead. They're gone. It's okay, you can have the land. But they weren't dead. They weren't in Sacramento to say that. So they lost whatever land they had. But even more, maybe more importantly, they lost, because then they kind of were considered dead, they didn't get federal recognition as a tribe. And so they've been trying to do that for many, many years. And so this is a long story. I didn't mean to tell you the full story, but it was a point to what I'm going to teach about today. And their most sacred land is down there just south, just around the area of San Juan Bautista, about 300 acres, that was sold recently to a corporation that wants to do gravel, sand, quarry, and dig it all up. And apparently also to do oil drilling there, because apparently there's oil underneath. But, it, you know, they have, that's the burial ground for their, there's lots of graves there, and their sacred places for ceremonies, and all kinds of things that they know about. So there was a march from San Juan Bautista, the 5 miles to the place where this quarry was threatening to be. Mostly you get the attention of the board of supervisors who could approve this or not. And so I was invited, and it was kind of an amazing and wonderful thing to meet that culture and the intersection of it and you know, be connected to the indigenous people of this area. And you know, I learned a little bit about their story, and A lot of it was very moving. I think probably the thing that almost brought me to tears was they had a, before the march, the 5 miles we hiked, there were speeches. It's very a lot of short speeches there were, and there was one of the last little speech in a sense, a presentation, was from four teenagers from they were probably 13, 14, 15 years old. Teenagers from their tribe who stood up on stage and spoke, and I said, wow, the kind of injustice just goes on and on and on, the impact of their lives, and what are they going to grow up in? And somehow I was more touched by them than, it was touched by all of them, but by thinking about the generational continuity of these challenges this people have with their own land, and feeling of belonging, feeling of identity, feeling of all kinds of things. But one of the things they talked about a lot was they used the word sacred a lot. And they felt they had a sacred connection to the land, to Mother Earth, sacred connection to particular areas, sacred objects. There were all these things that were sacred. And every time they used the word sacred, I was inspired. I could feel their reverence and their care. And for me, what was particularly nice to hear was they felt that the creator, the Mother Earth or something, it was never clear what that is for them, had given them the charge to be stewards of the land, of the earth. And they saw it as their primary task, it seemed to be from what I heard, was to heal the earth. From all the environmental damage that exists and that's seen and been part of and as witnesses of. And it was in the context of being kind of the stewards and healers of the earth that they kept talking about the sacred. And so it was this reverence and care. For me, it was quite inspiring. So as I left that, I was wondering about this word sacred. Generally in Buddhism, we don't use the word very much. And so I said, well, what's sacred for us, for Buddhists? Or what about this word sacred? So I thought I would try to talk about that a little bit. And I'm aware that the word sacred, as far as I know, there's no direct equivalent in the ancient Buddhist language. Unless it's Dharma itself, but Dharma means almost everything. And certain things are considered with great reverence in Buddhism, and so maybe in that sense there may be sacred. But I find it fascinating that some of the words that are used in English in places like the United States that can be very centrally important in people's vocabulary, like the word sacred, or like the word religion, religious, or like the word spiritual. If you go, I can bring you the Pali Text Society Buddhist English Dictionary, or the Pali English Dictionary, and look at these ancient languages, and there's no really good equivalent. And scholars say in Indian languages, there's not really a wonderfully perfect words for the English word religion. In fact, when Japan opened to the West in 1850 or so, 60s, and they started meeting Western culture and learning English and things like that and studying in the Western universities. And they had to invent a word, a Japanese word, for religion because they had no word in Japanese for religion until they had to make one up to make it match. So it's kind of interesting that words that are kind of second nature for some people here in the English-speaking country, and like everyone understands what it means, doesn't quite work in other cultures. And I find that fascinating for those of us who might grew up in English-speaking cultures to kind of see centrally important terms are not so centrally important in other cultures. Maybe some of the things that those terms refer to are related to things in other cultures or in Buddhism, but they don't quite match. And one of the things that I reflect on when I think about this is that the origins of this English word sacred, it comes from Latin, And it means, it, you know, it kind of means sacred, and sacrifice means to make sacred. But it's the words in Latin was used in contrast to the profane. And profane in Latin, the word fane, fanu, it means, or fanum, means the temple. And pro is in front of, so in front of the temple. And so there was a geographic distinction between what was outside the temple and what was in the temple. And in the temple was where it was sacred, and outside it was not. So the word profane and sacred have their beginning in a really kind of clear geographic or location-based separation of two different realms. And perhaps that sense of separation has continued for a long time. And when people talk about sacred, it's often in contrast to what's secular or ordinary or profane. And so some people will consider certain parts of their life sacred and not others. And some people have suffered dramatically in the West about this division. For example, the human body is not sacred, but something else is sacred. Or sexuality is not sacred, but other things are dramatically sacred, like asceticism or something. And so, what is it that's, so the word sacred, do we want to adopt it in English for talking about Buddhism? And many years ago, I tried to use the word holy instead, because some of you know this, that the word holy comes from the Germanic root to be whole. And it was about the 1500s that in English they added the W in front of the H. And the word holy, in Norwegian, where I'm from, I speak, the word whole is hel, and sacred is heli. And the E part is like the Y in English for holy. So, these words. So holy has a holy lost a W. Whole has a W. The whole shebang. And I kind of like the idea that what's holy, what's sacred, is everything. And is the whole. And so, what Buddhist practice points to. And this is one of the things I consider to be kind of, for me, kind of one of the more sacred things, a place where sacredness is found, is not so much exactly out in the world, but rather in the mind's relationship to the world. The world, from a Buddhist analysis, is neither sacred nor profane, is neither good nor bad, because the Buddhist point of view, the world was not made by a creator, by God, that made it sacred or something. In Buddhist terminology, it might be disappointing for some people to hear, but from a Buddhist orientation, the world just is the world. It's just what it is. And there isn't kind of a putting good, bad, holy or profane on top of it. It's just what's given, kind of. But the place where the whole is, where the whole holistic kind of way of discovery, is the awareness that doesn't exclude anything. The awareness that does not make these hard and fast divisions between right and wrong or sacred and profane, inside and outside. Those who are part of my sacred community and those who are not, but rather an awareness that dissolves the human tendency to get caught in these divisions. And the tendency of the mind to say, well, I'll be present for these things, but these things are not acceptable for me. I'm going to keep this out. And one of the places that people do this a lot is with things which are uncomfortable. Suffering, sometimes the suffering of the world. Some people have suffering overload. Some people just feel like that's not what they want to do. They don't want to feel uncomfortable. They want to just have a good time. And so there's, for many reasons, people will start dividing their world, and doing that, they shut their awareness. They don't pay attention. They don't notice something. And people can do that to the world around them, to people around them, but they can also do it to themselves. And in fact, I think any time we shut down, close up, or exclude something from our people or the world from our hearts, from our awareness, from our attention and care, I think that we're probably doing the same thing to ourselves simultaneously, that we're not really allowing ourselves to be full and whole. And that for a minimum, it's because when awareness is partial, when awareness is divided, and we stay with one thing and ignore something else, then we're separating ourselves from our full capacity for our hearts to be really open or our minds to be fully open. And so the direction we're going in Vipassana practice, in Buddhist practice, is to discover what it's like to have an awareness that does not exclude anything, that includes everything. That doesn't mean that we have to agree with everything. It doesn't mean that we have to say that everything is good, or everything is the way, you know, we just have to accept what's there. We might, in our actions, in our speech, approve some things and disapprove other things, but we will somehow the awareness or the heart stays open in all directions. So if there's a corporation which wants to somehow create damage, tremendous damage to a sacred ground, that's something to march against. For me, that's what I felt. But I'm not going to exclude the situation, the people from the corporation, what they're doing from my heart or from my awareness. I'm not going to contract and get caught up in my anger or my you know, whatever divisions my mind wants to, you know, might make. The practice is to stay open, keep open. And the reason, part of the reason for that, it's when nothing is excluded from your heart, nothing's excluded from the awareness, that's what's sacred. That's what's holy, and it's whole because then the world is not the what we take in, what we're willing to kind of be present for, is not divided. Is not, there's nothing outside the whole. Everything's included. And I think it's hard. It's certainly hard to do that, to learn that, and that's why we have a practice where we start slowly, step by step, recognizing all the big, small ways and big ways in which we. In you know, classic Buddhist language, we say we get attached, we cling, we resist, we're pushing things away, we're greedy, we're hateful, and all these things that are creating divisions and separation. But we start recognizing the way in which things get excluded and not included. And so then we open up. We learn to open. Or if we don't want to open, we learn to let go of what keeps us closed. And this, that the same, the consequence of that is we open, include more and then more. And it's a remarkable thing to end up with a awareness, a mind or a heart that has no clinging in it, no grasping in it, that has no tendency to shut down no matter how awful it gets around us. No tendency to shut down against certain things because we have tremendous drives for other things. No way in which we diminish our capacity to see the humanity of other people, because we have drives that, don't somehow include their full humanity, and we see so much of that in our society, through sexuality and through power and through, the capitalism and stuff, that greed that people have. That the full humanity of people is not included, and that's, I think, is what partly why I was so touched by these teenagers, Native American teenagers on the stage, was that for them they have recent generations of their people whose humanity was denied by this country. One of the men who spoke said that his mother, when his mother was 5 years old, was taken away from her family so the mother could be raised in a boarding school and not learn her native culture and native language that her family spoke. And he said, you know, the suffering of that continues. I carry that suffering in me, that what happened to my mother, because she really suffered from what happened to her being taken away. And so, you know, this still lives in us. And so, it was painful to sit there and hear this. And it's easy to imagine, you know, closing down, being overwhelmed, and you know, I can't do that. But how do we stay open? How do we bear witness? How do we... And I think that one of the ways that Buddhism emphasizes is know yourself well. Know how you respond to suffering. Know how you react. Know how you close down. Know how you are blind to certain things. Know how you prioritize your desires or your preferences or your whatever it might be in such a way that you cannot stay open and stay present and really take in this world we live in. And that's, a task of a lifetime, keep doing that and keep understanding ourselves. But the benefit of that is to then touch into something which I call sacred or holy, awareness which is whole, awareness which is capable of taking in all of it without any exception. And to discover that, to really feel that and sense that, to drop the agitations of the mind and the preoccupations of the mind and the reactivity of the mind and heart, and really discover this capacity for, you know, we often say capacity for peace, capacity for freedom. Many times the language of it is language is very personal in terms of feeling. You know, I discovered it's deep peace, which is, you know, a nice way of talking about it. But the corollary, what comes along with that, this is not just some personal experience, but an experience that we've dropped all the things that get in the way of being present and open for in an expansive way for whatever's happening in the world. And to have that peace and that deep calm and that sense of freedom and feel how that is a really dramatic sense of being open to it all and present for it all and ability to be really present for what no matter what it is and to feel that as peace, to feel that as freedom in the midst together with maybe the suffering that we might feel, the pain we might feel or what we encounter, I think is one of the great gifts we can give our life, our world. And so in a sense, the sacred is found in Buddhism in the way that we relate to the world, in the awareness that doesn't exclude anything. But when the awareness doesn't exclude anything, then everything that's in our awareness maybe is sacred too. And if everything is in our awareness, everything has a place in that expanse of awareness, then the earth is in our awareness. The people of the earth are in awareness. All of them are equally in our awareness. And so maybe that makes then the world is sacred as well. So even though Buddhists don't have this idea of sacredness so much, if it's sacred in Buddhism, it really has to include everything. And to discover that through an open heart is really, or open mind, I think is one of the great tasks and beautiful things. So what are your thoughts about that? Does this relate to you or interesting or relevant? Anything you want to say about this idea? You have different ideas of what's sacred for you or anything?
I was just thinking, you really threw out a big challenge there, because I have, actually, I came here tonight looking for some solace for what I'm calling my experience of echo grief, and needing some community in which to explore that. And the challenge is to stay in that level of awareness that you're talking about and experiencing everything. And I tried talking about this with some friends, and a lot of them want to turn away from it. And so I guess the challenge is that there are times when I must step away from it. And I don't know whether that means that I turn off my awareness to it, or whether I keep my awareness turned on and just finding some way to not be over. I'm kind of rambling here, actually. But anyway, I found a lot of solace in what you were saying. I guess basically that's what I wanted to say.
Well, what you said in the end, that sometimes you have to turn away from it, is true. I think the idea, if we include everything, we also include ourselves, what's going on inside of us. And sometimes in order to heal and take care of ourselves, we have to strategically take a break. We have to strategically do some inner work or some healing so that we can come back and be open again to everything. And that's a way of being inclusive, is to understand what we need and what needs to be done. And sometimes we're taking care of ourselves so that we can come back in a refreshed way and really meet it. And sometimes what's appropriate is to take care of what's around us and do something. And so have the wisdom of knowing where the attention should be, where the work should be. The idea is to, in theory, I mean, kind of principle is to be open to everything and then take care of what's in front of you that needs to be taken care of. And if you're the one who needs to be taken care of, then, you know, that's relevant. You know, this idea of being all-inclusive doesn't mean we deny what's here. It actually includes what's here in ourselves. And then we have to be wise about how to care for it.
Can I follow up just a second? I was struck by your saying that the march was appropriate to protest what this corporation wanted to do.
In my mind, yeah.
But the challenge was to be inclusive of the people heading up that corporation and including them in, rather than demonizing them, which is very easy to do.
Right. Yeah. So you know, a little bit. I had, you know, 5 miles was long enough to have all kinds of thoughts. And so I did have thoughts about, if I had a chance to meet some of these people, you know, how I would relate to them, what I would say to them, how I would talk to them, and, you know, with that very thing in mind about how to meet them as with respect and care, too. So there's a hand over there.
There's a, thank you. Yeah, I don't know if this makes sense to anyone else, but one of the most sacred things, or the sacred right now for me, is the present moment. And that's where I find solace from what's going on. When I am engaged in the sadness in the world, I'm not always in the present moment. And there's something about being in that moment, and maybe that's not the right name for it, but it feels like it. When I'm there, I'm not clinging, I'm not drawn out and messed up and destroyed by the world.
Nice. So, maybe being in the present moment, maybe it's the same thing I'm talking about from a different point of view.
I think it might be.
Thank you.
About a month ago, I was in a meeting with some climate activists who represent most of the Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish denominations, and we get together every month or so. The one that I'm thinking of, the meeting I'm thinking of, we tried a little exercise to develop empathy for people like the heads of corporations that may be polluting the world. Specifically, we tried empathy for people running oil and gas companies. We didn't do very well. We had a very hard time imagining, I would say, most of us did anyhow, imagining ourselves in their role, in their shoes, in their skin. I wish I had had your talk from this evening before that, before we had that meeting.
Great. Thank you for that. Yeah, I think these are hard. This what we're talking about here. I'm not saying I'm thinking it's easy. Maybe my talk was enough, but one of the perspectives I rely on is the idea to separate the activity from the person. And so the activity might be, I feel it's wrong, it needs to be addressed, but the person's not wrong. Person is more than whatever, every person is more than what they've, their individual actions or choices, and so try to meet that whole, the whole of it, the person.
Quick question on what is sacred and what wouldn't be sacred. So in other cultures or other places outside Buddhism, if there's something sacred or holy, that kind of means there are also other things that are not sacred or not holy. So I don't know Buddhism much. I'm still trying to learn the principles. But in Buddhism, if everything the mind can think of is sacred.
What?
If everything is sacred in Buddhism, then what is not sacred?
Well, it's from what I was trying to say today, from one perspective, there is nothing which is not sacred. Everything's included in this open awareness. So there's not this division between sacred and not sacred. That's why I like the word holy, the whole, to include everything. In a sense, the notion of sacred falls away if everything is sacred. But still, it points to something. So I prefer not to have any. I prefer not to call anything not sacred. It's kind of heartbreaking to me that something would be considered not sacred. That somehow excluded that way from what's sacred or what gets our reverence or gets our care. But Buddhists do distinguish. We'll have certain things which represent things of great value and inspiration that Buddhists will have reverence for or will care for in a special way, differently than other things. And, so someone might say, having the statue of the Buddha is kind of sacred for us. And the mop closet, the way we treat things in the mop closet and the way the mops are stored there, you wouldn't open the closet door and say, "Wow, those people are treating those mops sacredly." So there is a kind of a distinction, maybe it's a sense of reverence, a sense of inspiration, a sense of care, a sense of it represents something that's maybe like the Buddha is just a statue, right? But it represents. I look at it, and for me, it represents that capacity to be whole, or not to include the capacity to include everything, and so we have something that represents that, but it's in conventional language you might say that's sacred, but the mop closet is not, but in terms of real religious doctrine or something, that we wouldn't make that distinction. And many years ago, I've told this story before, but maybe some of you haven't heard it. I was, when I was a young Zen student, I was sitting a seven-day Zen retreat at Green Gulch up here in Marin County. And in Zen, you often sit on a platform like this, and there's a whole bank of them all in a row around the edges of the room. And in that particular school of Zen, you meditate facing the wall, but you turn around and face out like I'm facing you. And you would have, like if you have meals, you have bowls like this, and you have this bowl and put in front of you on the platform, and servers come and serve you food and eat. But in the afternoon, like at 3 o'clock or so in the afternoon of these seven-day intensive meditation retreats, we would all turn around and face the center of the room, and they would serve us tea. In the old days, it was tea and a cookie. And so the first day, they would come in, and they would first come in with a teacup. And that teacup, they would take the teacup and put it down. Then they come with a cookie, and then they come with a tea, and pour it in the cup, and then you drink it. And then they would come and gather the... they didn't gather anything, because the cookie came on a napkin that you just put in your sleeves. But the cup you kept at your seat for the 7 days of the retreat. So I was doing one of these retreats, and there was a Zen priest, monk from Japan, who was there doing the retreat, and he was sitting next to me. And it was quite something to sit with him. He had a lot of samadhi, a lot of stillness. He was very poised. Everything he did, you know, you can kind of feel that he was really present for everything he did. Standing, sitting, everything was very, you know, it was wonderful to sit next to him. So it came time, at the end of 7 days, we had the last tea, so we didn't need any more cup after that. So then the servers came and picked up the cup and take it to the kitchen to wash. And in Zen, everything is choreographed, like when you bow, when you stand, when you sit down, what foot goes forward when, and, you know, it's all this stuff, right? And which direction you turn, and it's like, you know, if you study dance, you might love Zen. And so if someone does something which isn't part of their choreograph, it stands out. You can notice right away. So they were coming to get the cups, and this priest next to me, before he gave up the cup, he bowed to the cup. And that kind of blew me away. And, you know, wow, he's bowing to the cup out of gratitude or respect or care or some sense of the cup was special. And a cup is just a cup, right? For, you know, who would pay attention? Who would want to bow to a cup? It's just a glass, right? You know. But the fact that he would also include that into what he would revere or respect or offer his gratitude to, that to be in the world that you're ready to bow to everything, no matter what it is. And so you would even bow to the people who you have huge differences with, and you're ready to bow to anyone. I think that's one of the beautiful things, I think, that I've seen in much of Buddhism. And maybe it's a different way of saying what I'm talking about here, is they're always willing to bow to everything, everyone. We might not agree, we might not feel that it should stay the way it is, but we bow. And one of the wonderful... ideas around bowing that I learned in my early years of Zen, when we did a lot of bowing, is when you can do nothing else about a situation, bow to it. When it's hopeless and you can't do anything else, you've tried, you could always bow to it. And that's quite a profound idea. And, you know, so many of us will come in situations where we can't do anything about it. It's whatever the situation is. Beyond our control, we can't change anything in all kinds of ways. And Maybe it's when it's your turn to die. So you bow to your dying. Or maybe it's injustice in the world that you can't change. What would it mean when you can't do anything about it? Maybe always you can, but can you bow to it? What is that? What would that mean? And is that offensive that you would bow to injustice? Or is it somehow a healing gesture or a powerful gesture? That everything's included, everything's held in our hearts, everything somehow. So if this is what I'm talking about today, about developing an awareness that's all-inclusive, not shutting anything out of your heart, anything out of your awareness, if that doesn't seem inspiring or points to something that's sacred, then I offer you the challenge or the exercise that either really or just in your mind's eye, bow to everything for a while and see what that does to the world you live in. And I suspect that if you do that, that the world you live in will start feeling pretty special if you take the time to take your cup and bow to it, bow to the people you're with, bow to the impossible situations you're in. Just always bow. When in doubt, bow. That was a Zen saying I made up for my, well, Zen saying. I made it up for myself when I was at Zen practice. Gail, when in doubt, bow. So, thank you all.